The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, everyone. Welcome to IMC. Can you hear me all right? No. A little bit louder? So, let's see, how's that now? Is that better? And out there as well? Good. A little bit louder out there. Let's see, it's a little bit loud in here now. I wonder if we could... There might be a knob out there. Anybody can turn it up out there? Do you know how to turn it up out there? Maybe. You know how to do it, Peter? It's So let's see, is it, I don't think I want to have it.
If people are having difficulty, take one of the earphone devices, and there are devices, seats.
And there are some seats, a couple of seats in here. Okay. So, it is Mother's Day. So I thought we would bring in the goddess. We don't spend much time with goddesses here, knowingly, or maybe we do all the time. So maybe it's Goddesses Day, and we can all be goddesses. Wouldn't that be nice? And so there's a poem, or a sutra, a Buddhist scripture. In Buddhism, Buddhist scriptures periodically get discovered. And especially in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition, they find them all kinds of places. They find them buried deep in caves, they find them in the ocean, and they get suddenly new revelations appear. And this particular discovery of a sutra happened at a retreat in Ojai, California, being taught in the late 1980s, I believe, by Thich Nhat Hanh. And it was a retreat for, I think it was a retreat for artists, musicians, and a lot of them came gathered together. And I think he encouraged creativity as part of the retreat. And if some of you know Thich Nhat Hanh and his retreats, Thich Nhat Hanh, when he walks, the whole world walks slow. If you have a chance to be near him when he's walking, like, you just slow down. It's quite something. Sometimes he leads people. He used to lead people on retreat, take them for a walking meditation around the properties, and there's a long line of people walking much slower than they would ever dream of walking. As he makes very slow, mindful steps, very present. So this idea of him walking slowly and mindfully through the oak hills of Ojai is probably in behind this sutra that was discovered in the mind of Rick Fields. And Rick Fields was one of the pioneer American Buddhists coming out of the 60s. And he was a student of Suzuki Roshi, a student of Trungpa, and wrote some books. He wrote a kind of important book for a little while in the 80s on the history of Buddhism in America called When the Swans Come to the Lake. And so he, in his wonderful mind, discovered this very short sutra on the meeting of the Buddha and the goddess. So it begins this way. And you know, many sutras begin, those of you don't know, they begin with, "Thus have I heard." So this one begins, "Thus I have made up." Once, the Buddha was walking along the forest path in the oak grove at Ojai. Walking without arriving anywhere or having any thought of arriving or not arriving. And lotuses shining with morning dew miraculously appeared under every step, soft as silk, beneath the toes of the Buddha. when suddenly, out of the turquoise sky, dancing in front of his half-shut, inward-looking eyes, shimmering like a rainbow or a spider's web, transparent as the dew on a lotus flower, the goddess appeared quivering like a hummingbird in the air before him. She, for she was surely a she, as the Buddha could clearly see with his eye of discriminating awareness wisdom, was mostly red in color, though when the light shifted, she flashed like a rainbow. She was naked, except for the usual flower ornaments goddesses wear. Her long hair was deep blue, her two eyes fathomless pits of space, and her third eye a bloodshot of ring of fire. The Buddha folded his hands together and greeted the goddess thus, "O goddess, why are you blocking my path? Before I saw you, I was happily going nowhere. Now I'm not sure where to go. You can go around me," said the goddess, twirling on her heels like a bird darting away, but just a little way away. "Or you can come after me. This is my forest too. You can't pretend I'm not here." With that, the Buddha sat, supple as a snake, solid as a rock, beneath a Bodhi tree that sprang full-leaved to shade him. "Perhaps we should have a chat," he said. "After years of arduous practice, at the time of the morning star, I penetrated reality, and now..." "Not so fast, Buddha," said the goddess. "I am reality." The earth stood still. The oceans paused. The wind itself listened. 1,000 arhats, bodhisattvas, and dakinis magically appeared to hear what would happen in the conversation. "I now take my life in my hands," said the Buddha, "but I am known as the fearless one, so here goes." And he and the goddess, without further words, exchanged glances. Light rays like sunbeams shot forth so bright that even Sariputta, the all-seeing one, had to turn away. And then they exchanged thoughts, and the illumination was as bright as a diamond candle. And then they exchanged mind, and there was a great silence as vast as the universe that contains everything. And then they exchanged bodies and clothes. And the Buddha arose as the goddess, and the goddess arose as the Buddha, and so on back and forth for 1,000 hundred thousand eons. If you meet the Buddha, you meet the goddess. If you meet the goddess, you meet the Buddha. Not only that, this: the Buddha is the goddess. The goddess is the Buddha. And not only that, this: the Buddha is emptiness. The goddess is bliss. The goddess is emptiness. The Buddha is bliss. And that is what and what not you are. It's true. So here comes the mantra of the goddess and the Buddha, the unsurpassed dual mantra. Just to say this mantra, just to hear this mantra once, just to hear one word of this mantra once, makes everything the way it truly is. Okay. So here it is. Earth walker, sky walker, hey, silent one, Hey, great talker. Not two, not one. Not separate, not apart. This is the heart. Bliss is emptiness. Emptiness is bliss. Be your breath. Ah. Smile. Hey. And relax. Ho. And remember this. You can't miss. So what I thought I would do is to read parts of it again and then hear what you think of this. Maybe some of you can make some commentary, because every good sutra should have commentary. Thus have I made up. Once the Buddha was walking along the forest paths in the oak grove at Ojai, walking without arriving anywhere or having any thought of arriving or not arriving. And lotuses shining with morning dew miraculously appeared under every step, soft as silk beneath the toes of the Buddha. When suddenly, out of the turquoise sky, dancing in front of his half-shut inward-looking eyes, shimmering like a rainbow or a spider's web, transparent as the dew on a lotus flower, the goddess appeared quivering like a hummingbird in the air before him. What do you think of that? You're walking along quietly by yourself, practicing on retreat, meditating quietly on your seat, not bothering anybody, intent on your practice, and then uninvited, the goddess comes. What do you think of that? This is just an obstruction, a nuisance. Is there any commentary about this so far? What do you think about this?
It really happened.
What?
It really happened.
It really happened. Great. It's happening now. So what did you say?
I think goddess is part of Buddha, the part that he's not aware of, and suddenly becomes aware.
So the Buddha is... A goddess is part of the Buddha that he's not aware of and suddenly becomes aware of her. So maybe it's a little bit the idea of becoming whole, that maybe we're divided sometimes from ourselves. So that's one idea. Thank you. Commentary. What? Yeah.
And he came into her forest, mm-hmm. not invited. But we kind of have a tradition of male dominance.
Let me see if I can repeat it. Maybe we should start using the mic. So the idea being that I said that Buddha was sitting meditating, or implied this, and she came uninvited. And that's from the point of view of the Buddha, one more example of male dominance, male-centered perspective. It was her forest too, you know, and you could say the Buddha appeared uninvited for her because, she was there first maybe.
So what struck me in the reading was inward looking, which I kind of don't expect. I expect it to be more balanced, both inward and outward.
So for the Buddha, it was inward looking and right. more balanced. And so maybe that was half the world he left out.
Right, and it kind of appeared to him all of a sudden as a revelation that it shouldn't be just inward looking, that it's also outward.
Maybe she was always there.
And just appeared.
He was preoccupied. Okay.
The thought I had is, you never know who's going to show up next in your life.
You never know what's going to show up. Good.
And
what?
Naked.
Yeah. She said naked with flowers. So one more, and then I'll read more. Right behind you, Bill.
I I think I got the gist of the poem, but I sort of had a negative reaction to the implication that the Buddha did not understand what is going on, because as a part of the refuge, I take for granted that the Buddha knows, like, he may not know all the particulars, but he understands how the universe works. So there was some, when they were talking, when the poem mentioned that the Buddha was, he got confused. That was...
That he was confused.
Oh, he didn't say he was confused, but he said, like, you know, oh, now I was going nowhere, but now I'm not sure where I'm going. And it, so that was... And I guess, like, it put me off balance a little bit.
Okay, so some implication that this is the Buddha was a little confused, didn't know what to do. He was kind of surprised by something that came along. And if he was really the Buddha, he should have been kind of all-knowing and prepared for kind of everything and open to everything. Okay, thank you. Okay, so then it goes on. So I forget exactly where I left off, but... She was surely a she, as the Buddha could clearly see, with his eye of discriminating awareness wisdom, was mostly red in color, though when the light shifted, she flashed like a rainbow. She was naked except for the usual flower ornaments goddesses wear. Her long hair was deep blue, her two eyes fathomless pits of space, and her third eye a bloodshot ring of fire. The Buddha folded his hands together and greeted the goddess thus, "O goddess, why are you blocking my path? Before I saw you, I was happily going nowhere. Now I'm not sure where to go." "You can go around me," said the goddess, twirling on her heels like a bird, darting away, but just a little way away. "Or you can come after me. This is my forest too. You can't pretend I'm not here."
It really happened.
Yes.
I'm reminded of the historical Gautama the Buddha and many other teachers, many of whom were males in the early days. And they had to face the reality when it started, like 2,500 years ago approximately. They always taught other males to be monks. And was it Ananda or one of the early disciples who said, "What about females? What about women?" And for a long time, he hesitated. That's what I remember. And he said, "I don't want to go there because it's going to complicate things." So he wanted just male disciples, keep life simple and so on. But at some point he said, "Yes, I will do that. I'll have female disciples." And, you know, and I think there's even a story that says that it's going to delay the nirvana of many people as soon as there are males and females. So I think there's some kind of a historical reference, and also the same confusion that arises when we take on the vows of celibacy or any of those things, as to how do you deal with this delicate matter and how do you work with it and work through it. That's one of the things she says, that you can go work around me, go around me, or you can pursue me, as if there's no third alternative.
Yeah. So thank you. So the historical context for this is interesting. So you pointed out the ancient context maybe for it. Rick Fields wrote this in the late 80s, early 90s. And the 1980s was really the I don't know what to call it exactly, but the when feminism really came into American Western Buddhism in a big way. And there were a lot of conferences, women in Buddhism, a lot of writings were happening, and the consciousness of that and dealing with the misogyny of Buddhism, dealing with the separation of it, was a big in the background of this poem. I think that who knows what the Buddha was like, but Buddhism was kind of split around this in some ways, and there was a very dramatic story from that I think early 90s. There was a group of Western Buddhist teachers who went to Dharamsala to see the Dalai Lama, and and to talk about some of the important issues of Buddhism in the modern world, Buddhism in the West. And one of the issues they talked about was the place of women in Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism as well. That there isn't really a full or wasn't really a full ordination of women as nuns, just like in Theravada, there isn't a struggle around it. And so they were discussing this, and then maybe I shouldn't say who I think it was, because I don't really remember so well, but one of the Western teachers there, a woman, I think she was a Tibetan teacher, Westerner, asked the Dalai Lama if she could guide him in a guided visualization. And so he said, okay. And so she did a guided visualization of him coming into a Buddhist meditation hall, Dharma hall, where there's some teachings. He's coming into the hall, and he's asked to sit in the back of the hall. And he looks around, and he sees that there's a woman teaching up in front. And there's other women teachers sitting next to her, all kind of in a row and very upright and stately and all that. And then there's pictures along the wall of past teachers, and they're all women. And the women who come to hear the teachings, they get to sit closer up front. Mm. And she was basically telling the Dalai Lama what was already happening in some places of Tibetan Buddhism, but in reverse, right? And the story goes that he started crying at that. So, I think this kind of split, Rick Fields is trying to address this as well in some kind of way. So there is something more going on here than that's it maybe have some interest for us. So I saw your hand go up, and maybe pass it down to your left, straight down your row to your left.
Well, I think she was the goddess of Maya.
The god, which means?
That means that we all are Buddhas uh-huh. when we do the meditation.
Uh-huh.
And we have a Maya all around us.
And Maya usually means illusion.
Illusion.
So what do you mean by this? Because fill me in.
Illusion comes in all different ways. In uh-huh. For the man, it's a woman. And then we have like housework and the kids' responsibilities yeah. or other things yeah. When we do the meditation. Uh-huh. So we all are the Buddhas and we have lots of Mayas around us.
I see.
So either we go around them, we accept them, then uh-huh. of course all uh-huh. the work, all the illusion will be there and mm-hmm. we have to stay like a Buddha. And do our meditation.
Great. So what you're pointing to is a little bit not Buddhist language to talk about Maya. It's a fine thing you said. Mm-hmm. But there are similar language in Buddhism where there's kind of a divide. Some Buddhists will use a language. Just recently someone used a language with me of the ultimate and the relative. Liberation and the path of liberation. And then, they're separate from that. There's the ordinary life of kids and diapers and getting them to school on time and work and jobs and sometimes in some places in Buddhism, there's quite a divide between those two and sometimes even an attitude of one is not really the real thing. And the real thing is sit and meditate and practice. And I think that Rick Fields was also responding to that kind of issue because in American Buddhism in the 60s and 70s and 80s, sometimes there was a very dramatic split between the idealistic young people who really wanted to meditate. They thought meditation was really where it was at. And sometimes it was quite painful because people who had families, they felt like they had to leave them behind or not include them. Or if they had children, the children weren't invited to come to the retreats, and they were just a nuisance. And one of the things that Thich Nhat Hanh did, which was revolutionary for here in America back in the 80s, he started offering retreats that included the families and children. And so there wasn't this divide. And So sometimes there has been in Buddhism a very strong divide between these two different worlds in one way or the other. And so it probably has, it's appropriate, I think it's appropriate in some ways to have a divide, a separation, but it can be done too strictly, too idealistically and with aversion. And so here, what you're talking about is the healing of that split, where we bring together these two parts that you're calling Buddha and Maya. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Because we can do all the meditation.
So housework is not...
With them living in the family, we don't have to go in the forest to do the meditation.
Mm-hmm. Great.
And that's what the original Buddha said.
Great.
When we asked that, all the women ask, how do we do the meditation? Because we have so much responsibility. Mm. And he said, that is the trick. that you do the meditation with all the responsibilities. And then you will find the way if you really want to do it.
Nice. There's another great story of, there's an American teacher named Kamala Masters. She lives in Hawaii. Some of you know the story. She was a very great practitioner, or is one, a great teacher. And she, early in her practice, was able, she had, I think, 4 kids that she was raising mostly alone, and work, raising kids. And she somehow managed to go on a retreat with Munindra, an Indian Vipassana teacher. And at the end of the retreat, he told everyone, you know, you should sit, you should meditate every day if you're serious about this. She went up to him and said, you know, I can't do that at home. And he said, well, everybody could find time to meditate every day. You know, it's, you know. He said, no, I can't do it. No, no, everyone can, you know. You know, he was a celibate monastic type guy, you know. And so, but she had the good sense to invite him to come and stay with her. Said, come stay with me for a few days or a week. And so he did. And so he kind of was living in her house for a few days and seeing what her daily life was like. And after some days, he said to her, you're right. But then he said, let me teach you how to practice with the life that you have. And then he would be next to her, or he would do dishes, well, you know, and show her, this is how you practice. You bring your full attention and mindfulness to just doing the dishes. And there was a hallway in her house that connected all the rooms. So whenever you're walking around the house, you often went through that hallway. And he said to her, when you step into this hallway, which you do many times a day, this hallway is your meditation hall. And you do a walking meditation, these few steps in the hallway. And so she did. She started incorporating and practicing in daily life for years. And then finally, when her children were old enough, she was able to go on a retreat. And she was so primed that she got concentrated and dropped deep into the practice, you know, in record time compared to other people, because she did this thing and saw it as her, she had to, and it was, it's a great inspiration. Let me go on, let's get through the poem a little bit, because so much here. So she said, this is my forest too, you can't pretend I'm not here. With that, the Buddha sat supple as a snake, solid as a rock, beneath a bo tree that sprung full leaf to shade him. So what a response is that? She says, you can't go around me, this is my forest too, you can come with me. And he sits down. Now, is this one more example of kind of like abandoning the world, giving up, and not engaging? But, you know, he didn't run away, he didn't walk away, he didn't go towards her. He just was fully present for her. Actually, I like this section quite a bit. It's kind of metaphorically, he wasn't for or against her, but he got supple as a snake, soft, relaxed, solid as a rock, just fully here. And he was just there for that experience, for what was going on. Kind of available for the experience, but not, you know, involved with desire or wishes or aversion, just there. It's a beautiful, I think, for me. But then he does something. A friend of mine, when she read this, said, this is a kind of a male thing to do. let me explain to you. I don't know if this is a male thing, because I've been the recipient of this from a lot of women. Let me tell you. I think it goes both ways. Perhaps we shall have a chat, he said, after years of arduous practice, at the time of the morning star, which is one of the myths of Buddhism, that sometimes you got enlightened seeing the morning star. I penetrated reality, and now. So someone, I was talking about this poem recently, and they picked up something that I didn't pick up, was maybe the connotations of penetrated reality, talking to the goddess. I penetrated reality, and now, not so fast, Buddha, I am reality. So what do you think of that? Commentary, please. Yes, here for Phil. Here behind you, Phil.
So all throughout this, she's inviting him to fight with her. And he's, his whole premise is, I mean, even the very beginning of the piece, he doesn't have a destination. He's not going anywhere, and he's not going nowhere. There isn't anything to oppose. She keeps inviting him to fight, and he just sits down.
Mm.
And I think there's this other message of, no matter what your intention, any intention you have in your life, there will be something to oppose it. And I feel like this poem is saying, even if your intention is to be completely peaceful, something will oppose even that.
Mm.
And my sense of the entire piece is that he just keeps changing his intention to be in harmony with what he's confronted with.
Well, great, very nice. I like this a lot, this idea. And I hadn't seen in the poem that she was fighting, you know, challenging him to fight. If anything, I saw her inviting him to participate. So a little different than a fight. But I think what you said is great. He didn't oppose. Yes.
So this reminded me a little bit about his enlightenment, mm-hmm. because when he achieved enlightenment, he touched the ground,
mm-hmm.
and it seems like a second enlightenment, that when this happens, he sits down, the Bodhi tree appears, right, and he feels grounded to the earth. It seems like a second enlightenment, where mm-hmm. he's addressing something that maybe he hadn't addressed before.
Mm, maybe, yeah, so he's coming back into that place of freedom, of liberation, just there in a way. Nice. So, not so fast, Buddha. I am reality. The earth stood still. The oceans paused. The wind itself listened. 1,000 arhats, bodhisattvas, and dakinis magically appeared to hear what would happen in the conversation. I know I take my life in my hands. Great thing. That's like free choice. And, you know, I'm taking responsibility. Said the Buddha, but I am known as a fearless one, so here goes. And he and the goddess, without further words, exchanged glances. Light rays like sunbeams shot forth so bright that even Sariputta, the all-seeing one, had to turn away. And then they exchanged thoughts, and the illumination was as bright as a diamond candle. Then they exchanged mind, and there was a great silence as vast as the universe that contains everything. And then they exchanged bodies and clothes. And the Buddha arose as the goddess, and the goddess arose as the Buddha. And so on back and forth for 1,000, 100,000 eons. If you meet the Buddha, you meet the goddess. If you meet the goddess, you meet the Buddha. So what do you think? Are you ready to do that? If the goddess or the god or the Buddha shows up, are you ready to meet that and fearlessly step forward into whatever reality is for that moment? Are you holding back from reality? Are you not participating in reality? Are you somehow mindfully trying to stay aloof and above it, or somehow apart from it? And what would it mean to exchange bodies with reality and clothes, change minds? What do you think? This part.
They see each other.
They see each other, which is such an important thing in Buddhism.
As simple as that.
Very nice. Yes.
Yeah, thank you for getting to the part in the poem that kind of heals some of the earlier part. What I wanted to say in the earlier part, even though I appreciate the sweetness of trying to include women in Buddhism, it was probably a step forward in its time. It itself is riddled with gender stereotypes.
Uh-huh.
I mean, the appearance of the woman is very important, what she's wearing, what she's not wearing, the length of her hair, and that kind of thing, and it grates a little. But then when it gets to this part of the poem, it heals a little bit because they exchange. The woman is no longer the other, and they
yes.
become one. And so I appreciate it when it got to that point. Before that, it was a little hard to swallow.
Yes, I can see that for sure. Yeah, we're here.
It seems that when they got together, it was a rather intense encounter with all the light and the silence and everything else. So maybe it's kind of scary to come together like that.
Mm. Have any of you gone on into meditation, deep meditation, and been scared by what was you saw, the experience of silence, experience of light, the experience of really being there fully? Yeah, a lot of people are nodding their heads, yeah. So it can happen. So behind you there. Am I calling too much on men here? Or is it mostly men that are raising their hands?
I could give it up.
You know, no, please, I should have waited until you were done. I apologize. Go ahead.
Just kidding. I think what I got out of that is when a man and woman, when they come to communicate and understand each other, then they become whole. They become one.
Mm.
So they become more complete when they understand the opposite. Mm. So they become one.
Great. Very nice. Maybe it's true for anyone. They fully understand each other, fully see each other. Okay. So one more, maybe. Do we have a woman who wants to speak?
Hi. For me, the goddess has always been a symbol of the earth and connection with the earth. Uh-huh. So that's what I see woven through here. And it reminds me of a meditation I had once at a beautiful place outside. Excuse me. And when I came out of the meditation, I looked around at these trees, and instead of feeling appreciative of the trees, I felt the oneness with the trees. There was no difference between me and the trees.
Mm. Nice. Great. So maybe one more here. Yes, please.
Yeah. What it was feeling like to me is that, like in meditation, I have to be willing to surrender who I am to become somebody new and to become one with what's emerging. Maybe it's an insight, and I'll see things differently. But there is a choice, and there is a saying yes,
mm-hmm.
again and again. That's what this... And so that sort of, to me, all of the changing of the clothes was the mixing up and the transforming, so neither was the same.
Mm, nice. Very nice. The little thing here that says, if you meet the Buddha, you meet the goddess. If you meet the goddess, you meet the Buddha, echoes a teaching that goes back to the time of the Buddha in the ancient texts. When you see the Buddha, you see dependent origin. You see the Dharma. When you see the Dharma, you see the Buddha. Or if you, sometimes it says, if you see the Dharma, you see dependent origination, dependent arising, which is sometimes taken to be a certain kind of description of reality. If you see dependent origination, you see the Dharma. So it's kind of echoing something that's in the background of the teachings. Not only that, this, the Buddha is the goddess is the Buddha. So if the goddess is reality, of nature, how could you be different? To me, it's been very meaningful, this idea that we are nature looking at itself. You know, we're not really apart from nature, and there's a long history of humans keeping themselves apart and being the custodians or the rulers of nature. But I think we're so deeply embedded in this world that there's a certain perspective of really appreciating our interdependence or interconnectedness. That's partly who we are. But what's, I think, one of the things to take into account is this poem depends on a distinction, maybe a duality, that these distinctions come together or get harmonized or participate or play together. And it's not denying the distinctions. So there is an experience of freedom, experience of awakening that happens to individuals. And it's when it's seen from the perspective of the individual, there can easily be a sense of, you know, separation, some sense of there's something other than that. And then, but how does that person who's free meet the world? And there are some, you know, or does, you know, do you keep staying in your freedom and allowing that divide to grow and grow? And I've known Buddhists who have allowed that divide to grow, where they keep themselves apart. But, what, you know, is there some way that freedom and the individual that gets free to honor that and see that, and to honor the life as it appears and as it's in front of us, where at both are true. Both there's a distinction being made, and there's a full presence, engagement in it, in some way. And this is, I think, where the poem goes. And not only that, this: the Buddha is emptiness, the goddess is bliss. The goddess is emptiness, the Buddha is bliss. And that is what and what not you are. It's true. So here comes the mantra of the goddess and the Buddha, the unsurpassed dual mantra. Just to say this mantra, just to hear this mantra once, just to hear one word of this mantra once makes everything the way it truly is. Okay. That's kind of challenging. What do you mean, everything the way it is? Everything's okay in Baltimore? You know, everything's okay in Nepal? What is this okay? What is it? What's the okay that somehow is seen through the eyes of awakening? What's the okay that's seen through the eyes of the goddess? What is that? Without denying.
It's not permanent.
It's not permanent. That's part of it. See it as impermanent is part of the okayness. So here it is. Earth walker, sky walker, hey, silent one, hey, great talker, not two, not one, not separate, not apart. This is the heart. Bliss is emptiness, emptiness is bliss. Be your breath. Ah. Smile. Hey. Relax. Ho. And remember this, you can't miss. Yeah, I love that ending. What does that mean? You can't miss. You can't go wrong. Yes?
For me, and I'll qualify this by saying I'm very relatively new to the practice, but I was trying to understand where it was taking me,
uh-huh.
and with openness and curiosity. And as the Buddha's walking and on the lotus leaves, it's a beautiful thing. And then all of a sudden we start talking about the sexuality and the nakedness of the goddess. So all of a sudden I start to have these cravings and desires about where that is leading me. And that's the way it continued. And then as Swatcha started to talk about the exchange, somehow I went from that intimacy and romance to a very maternal place. And the exchange of one being one and the other was, maybe this was your earlier reference to it being Mother's Day. I felt there was a maternal attraction there. And for me, unfortunately, my history is a mother that was not present and was not validating. And then what I heard, which was so reinforces what the practice is for me, is it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay, just the way it is.
Mm.
And that's the way it finishes, right? It's not about me being depressed about the past. It's not about me calling my mother today and saying all these beautiful, wonderful things because I think I can find more acceptance and love for her. It's just okay right here.
Mm. Great. I think it's one of the most profound mantras that American culture has given the world. It was okay, because it was somehow was born in the 1820s or 1830s in Boston. And it spread around the globe. And mothers say it, fathers say it. It's okay, it's okay. It's a profound one. So let's end with a little bit, any woman who wants to have the last word? On this poem?
Okay. Are there any poems written by women?
Are there any poems written by women? There's lots of poems written by women. And there's a wonderful, just to name a few of them, there's a wonderful modern Buddhist poet named Jane Hirschfield, who lives here in the Bay Area. And we had her many years ago come and be part of a poetry reading here at IMC. So you might look up Jane Hirschfield's poems.
So I just would like to say that I think that Buddhism, as with all most religions, all religions perhaps, is that there is this duality that's created between spiritual life and everyday life. And there's a schism between the body and the spirit. And I think that is deeply wounding for every person and for the planet. And I think that to the extent that we can really feel that we can heal that schism within ourselves and between and among each other, I think that there will be a lot of healing.
Great. Very good. So, skywalkers and spacewalkers, I suspect that if you pay a little bit of attention today, you'll see darting around you like a hummingbird, radiant and flashing into the colors of the rainbow. Some of you will see a Buddha, and some of you will see a goddess. And maybe it doesn't matter which one you see. Enjoy it. So thank you. And we do have the tea, and so everyone's welcome to stay and hang out and chat. And I'm certain that somewhere amongst this group, you'll discover a goddess or a Buddha. Keep your eyes open.